Now, at last night's private dinner in New Jersey, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu nominated Donald Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize, citing his role in helping to end the short but recent Israel-Iran war. The two also reportedly discussed a 60-day ceasefire proposal for Gaza that would include the staged release of Israeli hostages. Trump expressed support for Israel, but encouraged flexibility around a broader regional peace. Joining me on the line from the U.S. is Joel Pollack, a South African-born American conservative political commentator, writer, radio host, and attorney. He's also the editor-at-large for Breitbart News. Joel, thanks so much for chatting with us on the home run. What does Netanyahu's Nobel Prize nomination of Trump actually mean? Symbolic gesture or strategic message?
Well, it's both, really. I mean, anybody can nominate anyone for the Nobel Prize. I could nominate you for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, that would
but
be nice.
Coming from the... Well, I don't know. Maybe you've been on some secret missions. I have no idea. But
so secret, I don't know either.
Right. But the nomination from a head of government probably carries a lot more weight, especially when that head of government has been directly affected by Trump's intervention. And I do think Trump seemed visibly moved by the gesture. He seemed to be very happy, and he said that coming from Netanyahu, it meant a lot. Mm-hmm. So I think it was both symbolic and strategic, in that I think in the process of negotiating with Trump, you want to establish a good rapport, really with anybody. You want to establish a good connection and a sense of goodwill, and I think he achieved that.
What are Trump's red lines when it comes to Hamas's role in any ceasefire deal?
Well, I think he's said that Hamas cannot play a part in any future government in Gaza. He's also said that Hamas must disarm. But at the same time, I think there's some flexibility with regard to the fate of individual Hamas terrorists or leaders, and that remains to be negotiated. There's a very interesting idea that's come out of the West Bank that says that perhaps Gaza and the West Bank should be divided into emirates or little cantons, really, which has been sort of dismissed in the past as a kind of Bantustan strategy, but is actually a credible strategy because it relies on the leadership of local clans to govern specific areas, which is exactly the way much of the Arab world works, and it's the way the Gulf states work. And the Palestinian Authority is hopelessly corrupt. It supports terrorism. It funds terrorists in prison or the families of dead terrorists. It has no credibility anymore, not even with the Palestinians. So that could also be on the table. We don't know. Netanyahu will be here for at least another 48 hours, and the real negotiations will only begin today and tomorrow.
Joel, you mentioned the idea coming out of the West Bank. Earlier in the program, I actually spoke to the family of the main sheikh who proposed that. It was an article that was first reported in the Wall Street Journal and then picked up by all the other media. And he negated it. He said that it wasn't accurate, that the sheikh never said that, that he doesn't support the Palestinian feeling on the ground. I mean, be that as it may, it certainly is an interesting proposal. Do you see the Abraham Accords expanding under a Trump term? And in your opinion, why would countries like Indonesia or Syria be interested?
Well, it is going to expand. And countries like Syria and Indonesia are interested because the Abraham Accords are not only the key to a new Middle East, but the key to trade with the West. Syria is in need of trade and especially funding for reconstruction after the many long benighted decades of the Assad family regime. And the Abraham Accords can open up the doors. The Abraham Accords can also open up the doors to other Arab states who want to be assured that their investments in Syria and in other Arab and Muslim states are going to be managed properly. So I think it's a very positive development. And unfortunately, South Africa is on the outside looking in because South Africa has chosen to side with Iran and not with the Arab states of the region most directly affected by the relationships with Israel. I saw South Africa's deputy foreign minister signing a condolence book after the war, condolences for the dead generals and dead terrorists that fired missiles at Israeli civilians. And that's the side South Africa's chosen, unfortunately, but the rest of the region is moving on.
With Gaza still in crisis, how do these normalization efforts sit with the broader Israeli-Palestinian conflict? I mean, do you think that this is diplomacy bypassing the Palestinians?
No, the Palestinians have always had an open door to diplomacy, and they've just chosen the wrong option every single time. Anytime you have an opportunity for Palestinians to make political gains, they have rejected it, partly because they reject Israel and partly because the terrorists who dominate Palestinian politics reject anyone who might accept Israel. So the Palestinians are locked into terrible choices, but the diplomatic door has always been open to them.
Do American conservatives care about the Abraham Accords, or is this a bigger deal for Israel than for U.S. voters?
American conservatives care very deeply. It's one of the signal achievements of the first Trump administration. And so American voters have referred to it often in deciding whom to vote for and why. And it's been one of the things cited by conservatives in making the case for Trump. So it is something people care very deeply about.
Joel, you were mentioning South Africa choosing to be on the wrong side and siding with Iran. A couple of days ago, I actually interviewed someone, an Afrikaner, who headed a recent delegation of Afrikaners to America, and they sat with people in the administration and they expressed their concerns, and the administration asked them to come back and express that to the government. And no surprise, the government, DERCO, didn't give them a hearing and said they didn't have a mandate to hold those kind of meetings. I mean, that doesn't surprise you, does it?
You know, the very fact that it's called DERCO, what is DERCO? I mean, you have to explain to other countries what DERCO means. Why not just call it the foreign ministry? I mean, here in the United States, it's bad enough we call it, you know, our State Department, so that requires some explanation, but people are used to dealing with it. I mean, what is DERCO? Why did they rename it? It used to be the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, right? So DERCO, I mean, what is it?
And okay, I can't
right now
answer
it's
that.
Become a big, you know, well, right now it's become synonymous with incompetence and bad policy. So, you know, I'm not surprised they wouldn't meet with people. I see Naledi Pandor lecturing Afrikaners about what they should say and whom they should talk to and that sort of thing. And it's just ridiculous. DERCO really needs a change of heart, and it needs to adopt a forward-looking approach to the world, not one that tries to reconstitute the Soviet Union and all of its satellite states, because unfortunately that puts South Africa on the side of terrorists and terror-supporting regimes like Iran.
Do you think the Trump administration is losing patience with the South African government?
Yes, but it doesn't really matter because the South African government has no leverage over the Trump administration. So South Africa now is facing a 30% tariff because they've refused to negotiate properly. The visit from Ramaphosa was wasted because the South African media and because the South African government convinced themselves that the most important thing to do was to lecture Trump and not to arrive with any kind of compromises, despite what you heard me say on your station and others. And now they're also going to pay a 10% surcharge for adopting the quote-unquote anti-American policies of BRICS. So South Africa is actually going to face a 40% tariff. And it needs to change its approach very quickly, because if it doesn't, it's going to be basically left out. It has no leverage over the United States. And the best thing to do would be to watch Netanyahu's visit closely and try to do what he does, which is to say, be nice. Arrive with proposals. Arrive with ideas. And don't try to lecture the president. A little bit of flattery goes a long way, and not just with Trump, with human beings in general. So that's what I would suggest.
We've got one of our listeners, Etienne Swartz, saying it's not DERCO, it's JERCO.
One last question.
Joel, I have chatted with you before about the proposal to Afrikaners and minorities. Any updates your side? I mean, any inside knowledge on what is happening? Are more groups going from South Africa? We haven't really seen anything in the news our side.
I do know the numbers are larger, obviously, than the initial 49 people. It is continuing to come in, and thousands have applied. Right now, the attention in the United States is on immigration enforcement. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials who are raiding criminals and people who've been previously convicted of illegal entry, and they're sending them to other countries, sending them to their countries of origin, to other countries. And this is something the American people voted for, even if it's unpopular with the media. It's very popular with the American public. As for the Afrikaner refugee resettlement, it does stand as an exception, and I think it's a very important exception to the general pattern. It shows how much Trump cares about that issue.
Joel Pollack, South African-born American conservative political commentator, writer, radio host, and attorney, also editor-at-large at Breitbart News. It's always such a pleasure to hear your analysis and insight. Thank you for your time.